Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, how is the privatization of military activities compromising international conduct in conflict? And first, we'll take a look behind campaign events with one of the top campaign advance men. Stephen Jakes has recently written a book, Advance Man. It's a fictional account of the behind the scenes on the campaign trail. We'll find out how much of it is true to reality. Welcome to the Scholar Circle, Stephen Jakes. It's great to have you here with us.
Thank you so much, Maria.
It's rare we do fiction on the Scholar Circle, but I think given where we are and given your experiences and your expertise, your fictional account may be pretty enlightening for us all.
Hopefully. I wrote it as a novel and in an effort to be able to actually tell a truer tale.
Your book is called Advance Man, this account of behind the scenes on the campaign trail with events. Maybe we should start with what exactly is an advance man?
Advance people, back in the old days, they were just called advance men because mostly that's what they were back in the 60s. The Kennedys actually invented the concept of modern advance. And obviously, by the time I came around in the 70s and 80s, it's advance women too. But that name kind of stuck for kind of generically. And we are responsible for what you see on television. We're responsible for an entire trip of a candidate for president or vice president in order to create the kind of images that you see on television and in the still photos, too, and the next day in the newspapers, but primarily TV. So what you see is what we create, and what we try to, for lack of a better term, manipulate is an entire trip. So the media uses that 30 seconds of tape that we want them to use with the sound bite and something visually that enhances the message, that kind of graphically represents the message. And generally, you've got 2 or 3 days to put these things together, and often there are 30,000-person rallies that you've got, you know, 2 or 3 days from start to finish, and it gets pretty exciting.
It sounded very exciting from the fictional account, Advance Man, which I gather is real experiences that you have had, particularly with this one candidate who sounds very much like Barack Obama.
The main candidate, the candidate, as he's referred to in the book, a fictional African-American candidate for president in 2008. And it's set between the New Hampshire primary and the South Carolina primary. And it's essentially 2.5 days in the life of a lead advance person for this candidate.
So it really was based on some of your experiences, though the dialogue might not have been exact. There's still some reality embedded in this.
It goes back to my time, you know, not only doing a lead for then-Senator Obama in 2007, 2008, but back actually all the way to 1976, my very first presidential campaign, when I was on the national advance team for Jimmy Carter, and everyone since up until 2008. So I've put together all those experiences, so some of the things in the book may go back to the days when we could get away with a little bit more, and maybe not so much these days where we can't get away with as quite as much. I witnessed back in 76 and 80 kind of the last vestiges of what we call buccaneer advance. And back in the 60s, when there were no campaign laws to kind of put guidelines to any of what these guys did. And they would come to town and have to put on not only big events, rallies, they'd have to find all the cars for the motorcade, they'd have to find all the volunteers, which is what we have to do. They'd have to raise all the money to make it happen. And you cut some real deals back in those days to make it happen. That doesn't occur these days anymore. You've got a budget, then you know what your budget is when you go into a town, and the campaign will pay for it or the White House pays for it. So I'm capturing a little bit of the old days of buccaneer advance in my book as well.
You described at the very beginning of your book this sort of confrontation that you had with a fire marshal at an event who's concerned about if there's panic. But of course, you note that you're good at panic.
We're always in it. We're in a constant state of it when you're doing advance. And in the book, I say, look, and there's Secret Service agents around. There's adults around to control the scene just in case we lose all our ability to control our body functions. But fire marshals are always the bane of advanced people when you're out doing big events. You want to cram as many people into a room as you can. And if more people have shown up that can legally fit into the room, you don't want to stop. Now, fire marshals are one of those things that you just can't control. Of all the things that advanced people are supposed to control, which is just about everything within a half-mile radius, fire marshals are one of those things you have absolutely no control over, and they are very serious about their jobs. So I've gone to great extent to mollify fire marshals in my time, you just hit it. You go with it. Sometimes there's things you can't control.
And it seems one of the things that has helped allay their concerns has been getting them introduced to the candidate.
People really enjoy this, and some of them, you know, just when you need somebody to be smitten with the whole concept of meeting your candidate or your president, whoever your principal is, you run into somebody who doesn't care in the least. And so you can't win their good graces by something like that sometimes with some of these people. But most of the time, if you just treat them well and treat them, you know, with a little respect, then things work out okay.
One of the most amusing parts of the book was this character, Dick O'Malley, who was trying to do an expose. You said an expose on Democrats stealing Christmas from orphans. So just to guess that this was a particular Fox News reporter.
I'm not going to go that far. I'll say it's a compilation of kind of the attack news that's out there that will accuse Democrats of stealing Christmas from orphans, or back in the old days when they said that somebody was running for office in Florida and his sister was an admitted thespian. Now, this goes back to the 1940s, but that actually, you know, it's that kind of nonsense. I was kind of referring to that whole genre of attack journalism in this regard. Dick O'Malley is the character that's the kind of antagonist journalist that's looking to find the goods on the candidate. And the one scene that I described close to the beginning of the book where that character hits the trip director in the back of the head at a rally in New Hampshire, that actually did happen.
Would you ever disclose who the journalist was that actually hit one of your people on the campaign trail?
I don't know. It might have been somebody like Bill O'Reilly.
Well, I was wondering with a name like Dick O'Malley if it was Bill O'Reilly.
It could have been.
But no names here, but his initials
are. That's right,
it
could have been. But yeah, that actually is based on a real experience from 2008, early in the primary season. It was kind of an amusing little scene to watch as we tried to
describe that, because I thought it was really well done in the book, what actually happened. That character, the Dick O'Malley character, who may or may not be Bill O'Reilly, was rushing to essentially confront the candidate. And you had organized it so that it wouldn't turn out badly. Can you describe what happened?
Well, in the book, the character, the lead advance, was there for the build the night before as the team was building the site. We put up several layers of bike rack just kind of to keep the press area very clean and keep people from going actually into the press area who shouldn't be there. So there's always that, but it's also to keep kind of the press from going where they shouldn't be in the secured area behind the stage. And I could just see it was a big, wide open space, and so I'd put a couple layers of bike rack because you can't affix that to a floor in a gymnasium. You can't drive a stake into the floor and make sure it goes nowhere. It is easily moved. And in this particular case, it occurred that this television journalist was there and had just walked right through the secured area and right up to the last line of bike rack, and we put together a group of people to stand right there in front of the bike rack with their backs to that area to kind of block it. As our candidate at the time, Senator Obama, walked by to keep them from literally just shoving their microphones in his face as he tried to get by. And that's when the violence occurred. And happily, the trip director, in my book, as he's called Merle, smiled, turned around, didn't get offended by it, was kind of amused by the fact that he'd gotten hit in the back of the head, and turned and smiled. And so later, in my case, when I was in the motorcade, and I saw some photos that were sent by a Secret Service agent who was sitting in the stands, incognito, sent some photos, and there were great pictures of this occurrence, where the trip director's turning and kind of smiling. You see him in profile, smiling at this Dick O'Malley character.
Who may or may not be
Bill O'Reilly.
And then later, Senator Obama actually asked you about the incident, right?
It was pretty lighthearted after that. Actually, the trip director was kind of concerned, you know, as to whether he'd done something himself, had done something wrong. And so, you know, everybody else's amusement was tempered a little bit by having to reassure the trip director that everything was fine. Everybody knew where that came from. But it was true that as we walked in the lobby of this hotel after that, that the rest of the press corps started yelling to the trip director their approval for what had happened.
So there's a combination of things. You said in one part that it's really artistry. It sounded like that was a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but there was maybe a little bit of reality about your job. There's another time when you were talking about it being really kind of an addiction disguised as a cause. How would you describe it now, being not so much the writer, but just telling a friend how I describe this?
It's the most fun you can have in politics. It truly is. I mean, it's the most challenging. It's very much of a being in the trenches mentality with the people you're working with, and you get very close to people very quickly. when you're in this situation, these situations where you've got, you know, literally just a very few days to make all this magic happen, and you're going to be judged on it by the national media. It's probably as much of a challenge as you can have, you know, without being shot at. So it's a blast to do it, because it is very addictive, because it's short attention span theater. You have a chance to fill up a legal pad and create all this, create the events. You get the press afterwards, you know whether you succeeded or failed, and you go on to the next one. You're dumped into another town to do it all again. So it's quite challenging, and it's fun if you do it well.
Right. Are you still doing it?
It depends on who calls. Some friends had been after me for a year to help out to do a Bernie trip, and so I did a few Bernie trips in the Midwest here in Kansas City and environs where so I could sleep in my own bed. So I did three of those that turned into an interesting story that I won't get into right now.
No?
Yeah, no. In the end, it was a unique situation. So you don't put two old curmudgeons in the same room.
You mean you and Bernie?
That's right.
I'll take that. In your fictional account, there was another event, series of events, that sounded very real. In this case, there was a professor who was alleged to be engaged in anti-American activities. He happened to be friends with your candidate. It sounded very reminiscent of what Barack Obama was dealing with one of his old friends who is a professor.
There was a metaphor for all of those. I mean, there was a variety of those, not just with him, but with just about every candidate you work for. These little flare-ups that occur that are endless, you know, that become tempests and teapots, and for a very short period of time. And then it's kind of relentless. It just never goes away. There's, you know, it's just the next one, and then the next one, and then the next one. So I wanted to capture that within the construct of one, you know, one kind of worry about one thing that was written in college by this candidate. And there'd also been some stuff about that during the campaign of something he may have written in college. And just, you know, how silly it all becomes after a while. And it doesn't mean you don't have to deal with it. You're forced to deal with it. It's still silly nonetheless. And hopefully I tried to capture a little bit of the humor in it as well.
Now, I hadn't seen this story in the book, but I read about it in one of the other newspapers. It was a Mexican Independence Day trip to San Jose with Jimmy Carter. What was that?
Oh, my gosh. That was one of the biggest. We had other words for it. I'm trying to think of a good word for it. One of the biggest bad trips that occurred during the 76 campaign for Jimmy Carter. It was the Mexican Independence Day parade in Santa Ana. Long story short, he ended up walking a mile and a half parade route with then-Governor Jerry Brown. There was nobody standing along the parade route because everybody was at the end where the speeches were going to be. So they were walking for a mile and a half with, you know, a little cluster of people over here and then a little cluster of people over there. And in the parade advance team, keeping in mind I'm like the most junior person of a 20-person advance team in 76, but we got cattle trucks to put the National Press Corps in. And they could watch, they could set up their cameras and see Jimmy Carter and Governor Brown walking. And that turned into a disaster. They started mooing like cows because there was really nothing else to do along this mile and a half parade route. And then when these cattle trucks pulled up at the speech site at the end, we left them on there. So the cattle trucks were going to be the press risers. Well, the press risers ended up, you know, pulling up in front of most of the crowd. So most of the crowd couldn't actually see Jimmy Carter when he spoke. And it was considered quite the disaster. It was one of the worst disasters. There was other things that went on, but those were things that should have been controllable by the advance team. Governor Carter at the time had a tendency to be able to find his advance people in a crowd and look at them if things weren't going right. So I hid.
Did you ever have a disaster like that again?
Not in my events. Right. They make for better stories, but actually the Bernie story could turn into one of those, but now that the shouting's over. But no, actually, I had pretty, thank goodness, pretty good success in my trips. I try to keep things as simple as possible. So I haven't had any big disasters to tell the stories about.
The primary goal of the advance team is really about national media coverage. There's so much going on to try to make that national coverage look a particular way. I assume that there's an entire speech, there's an entire event, but you said you're really angling for a particular sound bite. How can you possibly get it to that?
Hopefully the sound bite is generated by the candidate or the president or the vice president, you know, making the singular point about the trip. You hope that occurs. And if you're good at what you do, you can also kind of create the scene where the visuals around it kind of amplify that particular soundbite. It's subtle. You're trying to, again, for lack of a better term, manipulate the media. The difficulty is that they know that you're trying to manipulate them, and you know they know, and they know you know they know. So it's difficult to actually do that in a sense. On the other hand, you know, visually, we have kind of a captive audience, and so they have to kind of take what we give them, the media, this being the media, in terms of their visuals. So whether they get the soundbite that you want them to, you know, ultimately it's between them and the candidate or the president, and in this case, the candidate.
What are some of the visuals that have made the best event here? So I know you've mentioned that a lot in the book. You also have mentioned it here while we're talking. I read a little bit about gigantic banners.
It was something I was known for to a large extent. Nobody else really did them. It was back in the late 80s, early 90s, the press, you know, not being insensitive to the fact that we were trying to put on non-paid political ads when we did our public events, kept getting closer and closer shots. So it's basically all you saw was a postage stamp size shot of the candidate, just the head. And so, you know, we created the step and repeat banners, the wallpaper, so that, you know, even a small piece of the background being seen, you could still see a message behind it. My feeling is when you're going outside, you go big, because if you give something the press can't not take, they'll take it. And so I was known for finding places, you know, such as the fronts of you know, the state houses, buildings with large columns, whereon I could affix, you know, 25-foot banners that actually just said the message straight out. You know, just go ahead and say it, give it two or three words, or just something that's visually exactly what you want to say. So I was kind of known for doing that. I did it for the Brown versus Board of Education 50th anniversary celebration in Topeka, Kansas, for an event with John Kerry in 2004, and thought up the idea of equality, opportunity, education, equality, and opportunity in 25-foot banners, and had them made within a couple of days and put up behind the event. So it was smack dab in the middle. And, you know, kind of said what the whole thing was about. And there were stirring visuals within Senator Kerry and leaders of the civil rights movement that were standing around him, as well as Governor Sebelius at the time. So did the same thing at the top of the Rocky Stairs in Philadelphia for a 4th of July event with, you know, Liberty, and I can't remember what the other words were, but there were three banners up there as well. So when you're outside, go big, go very tall, and the press will see that. And as a result, the press will then probably also see the greater portion of the crowd that you have and get more exciting visuals about what's going on.
So given all this and what you've been doing for these campaigns, what insight do you think you can give us in terms of these conventions that have occurred on the Republican side and on the Democrat side?
As it has been pointed out, I'm not the first one to say this, but this should be the ultimate in terms of a controlled environment for the parties that are putting them on. And not controlling their environment completely, you know, then the media has expectations that they should. You end up kind of getting less good press when things occur that you didn't expect to have occur.
Like a little plagiarism?
Yeah, that kind of thing, and anybody that's not fulfilling the script. And I look to see a little bit higher level of professionalism on the Democrat side, quite frankly, but I'm probably biased, but I think they probably will. You know, that's reflected in the coverage, whether it's subtle, whether it's overt, that's kind of reflected in the coverage. Most of the visuals should also be completely controlled in this situation. And if you're not controlling those, if there's a foment on the floor, if there's people saying things on the floor that you don't want to have said, then you're not controlling what's being sent out there. And people make their decisions based on what they see. Sad to say it, but people base their decisions based on emotion, and emotion is basically dictated by what they see, the visual acuity. So it's critical, obviously, they vote on emotion. It's pure emotion.
The book, again, is called Advance Man, and it's a terrific insight and very amusing account of what happens behind the scenes in all these campaign events. And with us has been Stephen Jakes. Thank you so much for being with us.
Maria, thank you very, very much.
When we come back, the privatization of military activities, what does it mean for international law and ethics in conflict? Stay tuned. Thank you. You are listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Over the past decades, private military contractors have grown to unprecedented levels, a change that has challenged the standing ethical doctrine known as just war theory, according to our next guest. Amy Eckert is with us. She is professor of political science at the Metropolitan State University of Denver, where she teaches and studies international ethics and international law. Her books include The Future of Just War, Rethinking the 21st Century, and her latest, Outsourcing War, the Just War Tradition in the Age of Military Privatization. Welcome, Amy Eckert. It's great to have you back here on the Scholar Circle.
Well, thank you very much. It's good to be back.
Perhaps we should start how you started the book, which was with this vignette related to the Colombian rebel group, the FARC, and the U.S. citizens that it had captured. What happened there, and what does it signal?
It was really a perplexing scenario. There were three Americans who were held ultimately for about 5 years by the FARC in Colombia after their plane had crashed and they were captured. And really the puzzling thing about the situation was that the FARC was characterizing these men as being prisoners of war, and it was really the U.S. government that was resistant to that. And I think in part it results from really a very genuine confusion about who these men were. They were actually contractors who were employed by a company called Northrop Grumman. And there was legitimate confusion over their status. They themselves weren't sure what their rights or obligations were. Were they obligated to attempt escape? There was just kind of generalized confusion over how these men who represented something of a new actor in conflict, where they fit in.
One of the things that I noted from that introduction was how we sort of blur the lines here because they are considered civilians. And there's a whole body of law that applies to how civilians get treated. And yet they were acting in a military capacity. And so how does international law deal with the civilian versus the military personnel in a case like this?
It's a gray area because, as you note, I mean, formally, they're civilians in part because they don't fall under the Geneva Convention's understanding of combatant. A combatant, of course, is someone who wears a distinctive uniform or symbol, carries arms openly, is part of a responsible hierarchical command, and complies with the laws and customs of armed warfare. Since most contractors don't meet at least one of those criteria, almost by default, they fall into the category of being civilians. Yet at the same time, if you look at the provisions in the Geneva Convention relating to civilians, civilians are really envisioned as taking no part in hostilities. So it's kind of strange because in a formal sense, they are civilians, but in a functional sense, they don't really occupy the position that we imagine civilians occupying. And in part, it's really a reflection of the fact that international law has done a great job with changes in armed conflict. And it was really around the middle of the last century that we saw a transition from international armed conflict being our kind of primary focus in terms of warfare to non-international armed conflict, civil wars, other types of internal conflict being really the focus. And while we saw some steps toward accommodating that with the protocols to the Geneva Conventions, international law as a whole really hasn't quite captured the fact that most of the people now doing the fighting and most of the casualties occur among people who are, in fact, formally civilians. So contractors are, in some sense, the tip of the iceberg. We also have, of course, rebel movements. We have organizations that would be classified as terrorist groups or transnational criminal organizations. We have, in short, a lot of people who are kind of in this same gray area being very active in conflict.
So active in combat and yet still with a civilian status because they are not technically with a military. And so how do we deal with that in terms of international law? I wonder if we could back up a little bit. You did a little bit of history in terms of the prohibition of mercenaries that started back, I think you said it was 1794, and what brought that about. Why did the prohibition on mercenaries start?
Certainly, it's the case that private force isn't truly new in the international system. If we look back to the Middle Ages, we saw states utilizing private force in the forms of mercenaries and privateers, people who would be issued letters of marque and basically licensed to go out and attack enemy ships. And really, over time, states began to realize that while there were advantages to using non-state actors and entities that weren't formally part of the state military, there were also a lot of drawbacks, including, for example, the inability to really exert control over these entities and to kind of direct their actions. So we saw things like privateers attacking ships that were associated with allies of the state that was sending them out there. And we saw, you know, states, in effect, not really being able to exert control over the private parties who were acting on their behalf. So eventually, states began to make moves to marginalize those private actors. So we saw, for example, prohibitions on piracy, and the concept of privateering went away. And we saw states beginning to exert stronger control over their citizens, their nationals, and they're selling their services as mercenaries. So over time, you know, these entities really became marginalized within the international system. And of course, they never went away completely. Of course, we had, you know, mercenaries active during Cold War conflicts and wars of national liberation, but they really weren't significant. And it wasn't really until the end of the Cold War that we began to see private actors reemerging en masse in the form of these private military companies.
So what, in terms of international law, is currently in place in terms of prohibitions on, say, privateering or use of mercenary? Is there any such prohibition now?
There is a prohibition on mercenarism in international law, but in effect it's a prohibition that's very difficult to apply to people. It's a prohibition that has a number of different parts to it. So, you know, someone who's foreign to the conflict and motivated by profit and a list of several other factors. And in essence, if someone's able to prove that they don't fit, you know, one or two of those pieces, then in effect they're not considered legally to be a mercenary. In response to the emergence of this new private market for force, states have taken some steps in the form of the Montreux document, which is essentially a document of best practices for states specifically that are hiring private military companies. But again, it's certainly not anything like a prohibition as such, which isn't really surprising because states want to be able to continue to employ private military companies, and they benefit from being able to hire them. So, you know, I think as long as that continues to be the case, we're not going to see states really taking strong steps to prohibit this type of activity.
Now, you mentioned that earlier the U.S. Neutrality Act and other concerns for neutrality were part of the international norm of not using private actors. How is it connected to neutrality?
The problem that we really faced at that point in time and you know, around that time that we adopted the Neutrality Act, the U.S. was a new state. We weren't necessarily a very powerful actor in the system at that point in time. And really the fear was that, you know, Americans becoming involved in foreign conflicts by selling their services as mercenaries could potentially drag the U.S. into conflicts that we would prefer to avoid. So that was really the motivator behind the U.S. taking steps to limit the ability of Americans to participate in foreign conflicts and to sell their services as mercenaries is in some ways a reimagining of the relationship between state and citizen. The idea that the state could restrict its citizens from, in effect, engaging in warfare on their own behalf or on behalf of some other state.
It's interesting because it seems like there has been a turn in terms of some citizens acting now in private capacities, and maybe we should talk about some of those. I think a lot of us have heard about what happened in Iraq, especially with Blackwater, and we should recount some of that as well. But what I found particularly fascinating were some of the other means of private military contracting, including the young man you described who created a private military company in aid of Darfur to try to prevent genocide. So this is like multifaceted. Can you outline all of the different types of private military contractors with like Blackwater perhaps being on one end of it, all the way down to somebody who created this in his dorm room.
You do get really a range of actors. I mean, the term private military companies encompasses just a range of different actors. And, you know, you see companies that are publicly traded, that are listed on the stock exchange, that are part of corporate conglomerates. And then you actually do find some companies that tend to be very small, very informal, kind of the equivalent of a mom-and-pop restaurant, if you will, except selling very different services. But, you know, certainly similar in terms of the opaque nature that we don't necessarily get to look at the books or get a lot of information about what it is that they're doing. And, you know, we see these companies performing a huge range of functions. I mean, certainly, you know, we do see companies engaging in the use of force on behalf of clients, Blackwater being perhaps one of those, and the defunct company Executive Outcomes, I think, being perhaps the best example. But we also see them really performing functions that are a little further removed from the combat field. We see them, for example, providing advice, training, consulting, and we see them performing also some functions that were once performed by the military, you know, setting up housing, tearing it down, cooking dinner, cooking meals, which, you know, we don't tend to necessarily think of those as being inherently military functions, but when you're able to kind of shift those functions to private actors, then it frees up more military personnel to perform those more central military functions. So it still very much has an effect on a state's capability to wage war, because they're able to, in effect, multiply their force without enlarging the size of the military per se. Beyond the battlefield, and one of the things that I think people maybe don't notice as much is private military companies really providing expertise to us on issues and shaping the way that we see them, which I think is a really interesting and important function, because, of course, they're motivated to frame issues as being military problems or security problems, because those are the services that they provide. So just by way of example, one of the issues I talk about in the book is the problem of state failure. And the concept of state failure was really developed by an organization with ties to the private military industry. So while we might look at failed states like Somalia and see them as social problems or economic problems, kind of the impetus is really to see it as a security problem that requires some kind of military action. So we really see them performing a range of functions, both on the battlefield and off.
This idea that these private military companies can shift the thinking or the decisions to going to war or not, I also found really interesting, particularly in light of that the motivation could be profit-driven. So the push for thinking in these ways, reframing the ideas of when to go to war, why to go to war, coming from a sheerly profit perspective in some cases. Now, that was one example that you gave. Do you have a sense that there has been a success among some of these private military companies, contractors, who would like to see more lethal activity for the bottom dollar?
I think we can see the influence of this kind of thinking. You know, for example, one place where contractors have been utilized is in the fight against piracy off the coast of Somalia and other places like that. You know, certainly there are other ways to approach the problem of piracy. You know, the people who are out there capturing ships and essentially holding the crew hostage until the insurance company pays out on the policy are really motivated by economics. They're not necessarily out there to cause harm to people or to wreak havoc or destruction. They're motivated, you know, strictly by the desire to earn some money. And, you know, we've seen, frankly, other states approaching the problem by paying them off, which is certainly one way to deal with the problem that doesn't involve the use of force or, you know, the deploying of security forces. So I think to some extent, I mean, we can kind of infer from our own response to piracy and to the employment of private military companies in that response, that this type of thinking and this securitizing, if you will, of issues does really have an impact.
Some of the other situations that you described in your book, I thought were also new phenomena that we have not really given ample thought to. And a couple of them were conflicts that were going on in Africa. I think one was in Sierra Leone.
They can have a very dramatic effect on conflict, and I think Sierra Leone is a great way to cut into that. Sierra Leone was of course, a country that was embroiled in a civil war. At one point, the rebels had actually pulled within kilometers of the capital, Freetown, and the government, having been unsuccessful in trying to improve its own internal military capabilities, turned ultimately to the company Executive Outcomes. Executive Outcomes entered the conflict, and within a very short period of time, say under 100 days, they had completely reversed the strategic situation on the ground and had brought the rebels actually to the bargaining table. So I think that the Sierra Leone is indicative of the kind of really transformational effect that a private military company can have, even if they're not necessarily there in large numbers. But I think Sierra Leone is also something of a cautionary tale as well, because while Executive Outcomes was able to force the rebels to peace talks and ultimately a peace agreement did result from that, once Executive Outcomes left and its departure was in fact a term of the peace agreement, the peace fell apart very quickly and Sierra Leone was essentially right back where it was. So, you know, I think it's something of a cautionary tale that tells us that while private military companies can have a very significant strategic impact, that impact may not outlive their presence in the country.
Or it can make it worse, as was the case with Blackwater, which, as I recall, created a worse situation in Fallujah than what might have been. I think we'd be remiss if we didn't recount what happened with Blackwater.
Yeah, I think your assessment is correct that the U.S. military was drawn into Fallujah because of the attacks on Blackwater contractors there. And of course, we probably all recall seeing those rather horrifying images of the four Blackwater contractors having been burned and lynched in Fallujah. Yeah, it's not quite clear whether the people there necessarily knew that they were working for Blackwater, if they thought that they were perhaps working for the CIA or some intelligence agency, but certainly they were ultimately targeted and killed by elements within Fallujah. And as a result of that, the U.S. military, rather than being able to kind of avoid being drawn into Fallujah, was pulled in a very strong way.
It was also an example of a private military company personnel, the personnel acting out in ways that would be prohibited in terms of what military personnel would actually do. As I recall, and I think you cited in your book, the Congress did an investigation and found that the guards were opening fire in, I think it was nearly 200 occasions, and most of the time they were firing first.
Yeah, you're correct, and that was ultimately found to be the case in the very high-profile Nasir Square shootings, which was, of course, the shootings that took place at the Iraqi traffic circle, leaving 17 civilians ultimately dead. And while the Blackwater guards had stated that they were under fire, the subsequent investigation just really didn't bear that out. We did ultimately see some prosecutions in that instance, and people were convicted of those shootings. That's certainly not always the case. And really, kind of the other high-profile instance from the Iraq War was Abu Ghraib, where half of the people involved in the detainee torture and abuse were, in fact, contractors from a couple of companies who were there as translators and linguists. And we saw a real divide in terms of what happened to the military personnel and what happened to the contractors. And every military person who was involved in Abu Ghraib was either court-martialed or forced to retire, whereas the contractors were simply pulled from Iraq and didn't really face any other consequences.
There were some similar types of violations, I think, in Afghanistan as well, weren't there?
Correct. There were allegations in particular that Armor Group had engaged in inappropriate conduct with respect to Afghanis, also inappropriate hazing conduct and so forth among themselves.
So these are some of the things that you were talking about in the context of just war theory, which has been sort of our international ethical document about when war is appropriate and how it should be conducted to avoid having wars go completely badly and immorally. So maybe we should back up a little bit and talk about the origins of just war theory and what it calls for in order to prevent complete and absolute immorality when it comes to conflict. So how did it begin and what are its tenets?
This is a tradition that really goes back as far as the ancient Greeks and perhaps really even earlier. And it's a tradition that has evolved over the centuries as warfare has changed. Really, since the rise of the national military, though, around the time of the French Revolution, we've really seen the just war tradition latching on to the political form of the state and really incorporating the state almost as an assumption. So it becomes difficult when we have actors in significant numbers who don't fit with that statist model. Just to kind of throw out a couple of ways that this really matters, one of our just war principles that helps to evaluate the decision to go to war is proportionality. In other words, is the war going to achieve more good than harm, or is it going to be disproportionately harmful? And this assumes that we have a good way to assess what the costs are, which, when you begin to incorporate private actors, isn't necessarily the case. To come back to the case of Iraq, at one point in time, we had essentially a one-to-one ratio of contractors to military personnel deployed in Iraq, so we had as many contractors as we had soldiers. Yet the casualty figures that the Pentagon would publish didn't include injuries or deaths among those contractors. So the information we were really given as the public was incomplete in terms of what the costs of the war actually were. And the deaths and injuries among contractors were more or less hidden in a way that kept the costs of the war artificially low. The government entity that was tracking casualties among contractors was actually not the Department of Defense. It wasn't the Pentagon. It was the Department of Labor. So kind of, a double standard, a disparate treatment, where we count deaths and injuries to soldiers, and we're a little less aware of casualties among contractors, even though they're there in equal numbers. When we're making the decision about warfare, when we have public actors acting in concert with private actors, we don't necessarily always get a complete picture about what's happening. In terms of the conduct of the war, we also have those norms that tell us not just when it's justified, but also how it's justified, these jus in bello norms. And, you know, again, the assumption that we're dealing exclusively more or less with states is problematic because, you know, as we were talking about the contractors in Colombia, they kind of straddle that military-civilian divide, and they're really outside the structure of a hierarchical military. You know, U.S. Army Field Manual specifically states that military personnel cannot give orders to contractors, which really undermines the assumption we have that everyone participating in war is kind of part of the same hierarchical structure.
So there are a couple of things I was thinking. One pertains to the numbers that you were talking about, the distortion of the numbers dead. Now, one of our producers, Mike, mentioned this morning that Vladimir Putin had admitted, or at least some of the media had quoted him as admitting to using these private military people as an effort to keep the numbers, the official count, down. Do you think that this is something that is beyond Russia and going on in other countries so that they can keep the numbers hidden intentionally?
I think it's certainly the case. If you are aware that people are more invested in casualties among, you know, uniformed military than they are among contractors, then certainly using contractors in greater numbers, you know, does function to deflate the perceptions about casualties. People will think that that fewer people are dying and that the war is actually less costly than it is. But yes, I saw actually the same coverage that Putin has reportedly, you know, utilized private military both in Ukraine and in Syria.
The other issue is, of course, in democratic settings, the idea of having things under a public umbrella is that the public has some choice in the matter. Once you start privatizing things, it takes the public's say almost completely out.
It really does. You know, in particular, in this question of private military companies, Yeah, in some cases there's very little public oversight, and if the contract is small enough, if it's under $50 million, there's not even necessarily legislative oversight of the decision to utilize private military companies. So it's it does pose a challenge, I think, to democracy. And I think, you know, one of the things that I came to realize as I was working on the book is that, you know, we're engaging in a conscious reversal in some ways of some of the institutional structures that are supposed to make democracies behave more peacefully in the international system. You know, Immanuel Kant, of course, wrote about this in his essay Perpetual Peace, and the argument in its simplest form is that if the people are faced with the burden of fighting a war or paying for a war, they're going to be less likely to fight unless the reason is really compelling. But if you're able to avoid sending your own citizens to war by utilizing private military companies, whether, again, it's one of your own country's companies or perhaps a foreign company, then you're, in effect, removing the incentive that people might have to very seriously deliberate about whether or not a war is a good idea.
And then that other piece that you were talking about earlier that comes into play, which is the influence of these private military companies on our norms and values and the what we would call in the political communication studies is priming, the sort of criteria with which to make the decision, bringing some more to the forefront. And it sounds like what you're saying is that is going on, and particularly in the United States, at least.
I think that's certainly true. I mean, increasingly we turn to private military companies not just for their labor, but also for their expertise. And, you know, this happens especially with regard to weapons systems that might be very technologically sophisticated. We may not have the expertise within the military to maintain those systems or to operate them. And we're also making use of private military companies for intelligence gathering. We're turning to them for their expertise in thinking about particular issues. There's kind of the expression out there that if you have a hammer, every problem is going to look like a nail. And, you know, we've kind of moved to the point now where we're turning to the hammer salesman for advice about what tool we should use. And, you know, they're beginning to point out, you know, all these additional nails that we hadn't necessarily noticed before.
So in context of just war theory, how are you proposing now to get this sort of under control so that we can try to go to a more ethical, moral model when it deals with international conflict?
Well, this is a tradition that is remarkably resilient. It's endured for centuries. So I think we can certainly, you know, begin to make just war arguments about wars in which private military are involved. I propose actually a two-pronged approach in the book, kind of divided along the lines of the jus ad bellum criteria that help us to think about when it's just to fight, and the jus in bello norms that apply to the question of how we go about fighting. And I think that when we take the jus ad bellum norms seriously, they function in a way to limit resort to force and to really be critical of a rush to war. And this requires really having a very complete assessment of what the ethical and strategic pictures look like. And I don't think you can achieve that in a privatized war unless you take account of both the public and private actors. So I think with respect to those questions, we really need to impute the actions and capabilities of private actors to state actors. Whereas if we're thinking about the question of how we fight, I think this is a scenario in which we can really have multiple parties bearing responsibility for action. So certainly we can hold individuals responsible for their conduct, and this is something actually that the U.S. has been moving to do in recent years through extending the Uniform Code of Military Justice to at least some of the contractors that we hire. But there's also room for responsibility on the part of companies that are employing individuals who may be, you know, committing acts that we think of as unethical or unjust. And potentially, I think there's also a degree of responsibility to be borne by the entities that might be hiring these companies as well. In particular, if they continue to hire companies that have had problems in the past.
A couple of things. One is the when to go to war part, which, as I understand just war theory, is supposed to be completely contingent upon self-defense. Is that correct?
Just cause, the question of why you're fighting is really central to the way we think about the tradition today. And self-defense is certainly the archetypical just cause, although we certainly extend our thinking also to intervention when there are human rights violations as well.
The other question, when you're talking about the codes being extended to the private military contractors, would that mean that international laws such as Geneva Conventions and types of prohibitions and remedies could be applied to private contractors more readily?
Well, we've taken the step of kind of applying international norms through national mechanisms. So our Uniform Code of Military Justice actually mirrors international law very closely, and it's the law that is applied to our military personnel. And what Congress has done is it has extended the UCMJ to apply also to private contractors that are hired by the Department of Defense, which is by no means all the private contractors that the U.S. hires. The State Department, for instance, also makes extensive use of private military and security companies for protection details for embassy security and so forth. And some other executive agencies also hire them as well. So extending it to the Department of Defense contractors doesn't necessarily mean that we're applying the UCMJ to everyone. But we are applying it at least to a significant portion of the contractors that the U.S. hires.
And then finally, you had noted very early in the book about how this use of the private military companies has grown tremendously from the Cold War all the way up until today. There were some pretty large numbers. Do you see that trend continuing, or do you see it tapering off? Can you get a sense of what is happening?
I think that we're seeing the raw numbers, at least that the U.S. is utilizing, falling a little bit because, of course, we're winding down major conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan. I think, you know, the extent to which we continue to utilize them will depend in part in terms of, you know, what develops in the international system. I think that to the extent that there's conflict in the system, there will be continued extensive use of contractors. And of course, you know, we're by no means the only employer of these companies. Certainly other states employ them, and we even see other actors, even other corporations, hiring private companies as well. So certainly I think the industry is not going away anytime soon. And I think that if we see you know, conflicts continuing to erupt and to grow, we're going to continue to see very extensive use of private contractors as well.
I was surprised to see they were, in some cases, used almost as the exclusive armed forces in some countries, and also, in some cases, as peacekeepers.
It's true. I mean, we even see international organizations like the UN hiring them, although they're also, you know, very critical of the private military industry at the same time. And in particular, I mean, we utilize contractors for a number of reasons, perhaps political purposes, that we want to be able to, you know, kind of send some troops under the radar, so to speak, or we believe that it's going to be a more efficient solution than sending the public military. But if there absolutely are states that are truly dependent on the private military industry to perform security functions, you know, there are some states that really are forced to privatize out of necessity. They don't have a national military that can meet their needs. They don't have allies that are willing to meet their needs. And so they've effectively got no choice, really, but to turn to the market.
Well, Amy Eckert, thank you so much for joining us here on the Scholar Circle again.
It was my pleasure.
Amy Eckert is a professor of political science at the Metropolitan State University of Denver, where she teaches and studies international ethics and international law. And her books include The Future of Just War, Rethinking the 21st Economy, and the latest, which we've been talking about, Outsourcing War, The Just War Tradition in the Age of Military Privatization. Thank you so much. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.
You know, one of the terrible things, I think, about the kind of consumptive life or consumptive society that we live in is that one of the first things it consumes is our history. And so over and over again, those things that would allow us to make coalitions, to make connections between the things that have happened to us, the things that have happened to our mothers, to our fathers, to people before us, are lost. And as I say elsewhere, we're constantly being put in the position of having to reinvent the wheel.
The Pacifica Radio Archives, the people's history since 1949.
I get upset when, even with my own children, I have to remind you, you know, you come from somewhere. You belong to a couple thousand year old family. And it's exciting to look back because it gives you ideas for the future.
Go to PacificaRadioArchives.org.
We must admit the past. Only the person who knows her past, his past, can begin to essay where she or he is today and how she or he may begin to chart his tomorrow, her tomorrow.
The Pacifica Radio Archives, the people's history since 1949.
Diving deeper.